And let's cultivate our motivation. And feel how fortunate we are to have the opportunity to explore our spiritual practice, to learn about our own mind and heart, to learn techniques to transform them so that we can let go of the attitudes and emotions that cause suffering and increase those that bring about joy. And so let's do this, not simply for our own benefit, but recognizing that we live in a universe where we are interrelated with everybody else. And seeing that everybody equally wants happiness, everybody equally wants to be free of suffering, then let's develop our spiritual capabilities for the benefit of all sentient beings. And so to progress along the path to full enlightenment, so that we'll have the wisdom, compassion, and skill within ourselves to best be able to be of benefit to all beings. So let's make that our motivation for being together today. Then slowly open your eyes and come out of your meditation. Okay, so it's nice to be here with you today. And to suggest that I start with just describing my own experience and go from there. So, once upon a time, I grew up in California, of all the crazy places on this planet, and encountered Buddhism in 1975, and Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa were my first teachers. And women's liberation was very hot at the time. And the person who was, the Sangha member who was directing the first course, told us that Lama was the incarnation of an abbess of one nunnery in Tibet. So we thought that was very nice, and he, we talked with him about our concerns because the feminist movement was just kind of getting going at that moment. He really understood, and he spoke a lot about women's inner liberation, okay? Because outside in society was going on the external liberation, but the real liberation happens in here, and this is... The real liberation doesn't depend upon whether you're a man or a woman. Okay, we're all in samsara equally. And the more you get to know the nature of cyclic existence of samsara, the more you realize that it really stinks. You know, and it's in the long term, it's not much fun. And it doesn't matter what your social status is, what your education is, what your profession is, what your IQ is, what your anything is, you know, wealth is, that none of that actually brings lasting happiness. And so that leads the mind to turn towards real happiness, which is freedom from ignorance, anger, and clinging attachment, and freedom from that self-absorption that causes us so much pain and inner turmoil. Perhaps now you've been at the meditation course for a few days. Are you seeing your inner turmoil? Yeah. Hello out there. Yeah? Are you seeing your inner turmoil? Yeah. Are you seeing how your mind goes out on all sorts of crazy trips. Yeah? I mean, this was a shock to me when I first went to my first Buddhist course. I thought I was a pretty okay person, you know? I had a few problems, but basically I'm a pretty nice person. And then I was listening to Buddhist teachings and doing some meditation, and oh my goodness, I didn't know I had all that stuff in there, you know? And really looking at my own attachment to all sorts of stuff, you know? I mean, you name it, I was attached to it. Except all the things that I didn't like and those I hated. Okay, so my mind completely involved with, you know, grasping, wanting, craving, and pushing away, get this away from me, I can't stand it. And, you know, this incredible struggle with the world. And, of course, you know, total self-absorption. The universe revolved around me. Don't you think your universe revolves around you? Yeah. First rule of the universe, everything should be the way I want it to be. Everybody should like me. Everybody should respect me. Right? Everybody should think the way I do. Even when I change my mind about what I believe, my new idea is right. My old idea was wrong, but it was right when I believed in it. Yeah? So this incredible self-absorption, we just get really tangled up, and it causes us so much pain within, inside of ourselves, and so much conflict among other people. So this was a real shock for me to learn about. And I realized I had some work to do, because even though I thought that all my misery was coming from outside, I realized actually my misery was coming from inside, and that the only way I was ever going to be really happy is by changing what's going on in here. Okay? Because as long as I have anger, as long as I have attachment and jealousy and pride and these things, wherever I'm going to go, I'm going to be in conflict with people, with society, even within myself. You know, and so really seeing that it's not the world causing my suffering, it's these disturbing emotions, and that these disturbing emotions are not who we are. Okay, we are not union oneness with them. Okay, they give the analogy of our mind is like the sky, very pure and open, and these disturbing emotions are like the clouds that cover it. Okay, so when you have a cloudy day, like yesterday when it was stormy, the blue sky is still there. Okay, so when our mind is full of turmoil, the pure nature of the mind, the untainted nature of the mind is still there. It's just obscured. Never gets lost. Okay, so if we can clear out the clouds, if we can clear out the disturbing emotions and attitudes, then the clear light nature of the mind remains. And that gives us the opportunity to cultivate our good qualities that bring about happiness for ourselves and for everybody else. Okay, so that was a big thing for me to understand, that real liberation happens inside here. Now, that does not mean that we ignore social problems. Okay. Doesn't mean we isolate ourselves from the world and I'm just working on my own inner liberation and society's screwed up anyway, so let it be. Go ahead. No, you know, we do what we can to be of benefit in society when there's oppression, when there's injustice, when there's whatever going on, then we do what we can to remedy it. But we have to do that with a mind of compassion, not with a mind of anger. Because whenever we try and intercede to prevent damage or to correct injustice, when we try to intercede but our mind is angry, then in fact our mind is exactly like the mind of the people that we're protesting against. I saw this so clearly when I was at UCLA during the time of the Vietnam War, and during one anti-war protest, somebody down the line from me picked up a brick to throw at the cops. And I went, oh my goodness, what's he doing? Now, I wasn't even a Buddhist at that time, but it became real clear to me, yeah, that if you react against injustice with anger, your mind is basically like the mind of the person you're protesting against. And so that's why it's so important when we're going to work in society to correct things, that we work with a mind of compassion, seeing that everybody in the situation is suffering in some way or another. Okay. So we usually, when we see situations, we see victim and oppressor. Okay. There's the victim. So, you know, it might be the Jews, it might be the Palestinians, it might be women, it might be gays, it might be African Americans, it might be, you know, whoever. Yeah. Those are the victims. And then here are the oppressors. You know, and here, you know, the poor victims, our heart goes out to them. Yeah, but the oppressors were angry at them. I want to beat them up. Well, you know, is that going to bring about peace in this world? If we have that kind of biased attitude that wants to harm some people in order to benefit others? It's not, is it? Yeah, and are the victims the only one who are suffering in the situation? Think about the karma that the oppressors are creating. Would you want to create that karma? Because whatever karma we create, whatever we do to other people, you know, as they say, what goes around comes around. We're creating the cause for what we're going to experience in the future. Okay? So the oppressors in one lifetime can become the victims in the next lifetime. Or even within one life it happens. Yeah. And so in order to avoid that happening by creating that karma with anger, you know, it's really important to have compassion for everybody in the situation. Also because the people who oppress other people, either by how they think or what they say or what they do, they are also caught in this iron net of self-grasping egoism. They're also trapped by their own ignorance, anger, and attachment. They're also bound to get old and sick and die. Okay? And so we can't say that they're on top and the victims are on the bottom, because everything's changing all the time, you know, within this life, from one life to the next, and so on. So I think it's much better to approach whatever social issues we're looking at with a big mind, recognizing that we're not always who we are in this body. Okay? And therefore the people we're dealing with aren't always who they are in their particular body or social role at that time. And to have compassion for everybody who's struggling within the bonds of their own disturbing emotions and karma. Okay? And so if we approach social issues in that way, then our own mind is much more peaceful, and we don't we're more effective in trying to correct things than if we're angry. And we avoid creating the karma to perpetuate this kind of difficulty in the future. Okay, are you with me so far? Okay, so now, back to my experience, yeah. Coming into Buddhism, I studied with, Tibetan lamas, principally. At the beginning, I didn't know the difference between Buddhism and Hinduism, between Theravada and Zen and Tibetan, between Nyingma, Kagyu, Gelu, and Sakya. And frankly, I didn't even care. All I knew was that these teachings helped me be happy when I applied them to my life. And so I kept coming back for that reason. As time went on, I began to notice that, you know, women are, there's certain cultural ways in which women are treated differently within Tibetan society. Actually, within all society. Yeah, we're probably from a variety of countries here. You know, in any of our countries, is there total gender equality? No. In any of our countries, is there total racial equality? No. In any of our countries, is there total religious equality and tolerance? No. Okay, this is samsara. Okay. So, I began to notice, you know, what was happening, in the Tibetan Buddhist world. And, for a while, I was, you know, it stirred me up a bit, you know, I was a bit unhappy about it. And then one day I remember being down at the temple, and we were doing a soak offering to His Holiness. A soak is a special offering that you do on certain days of the month. And at a certain point in the puja, three people stand up and they make a special offering to the presiding master. So there we were sitting doing soak. And the three people, as usual, who stood up to make the offering to His Holiness were monks. And my mind was going, why do the monks always get to stand up and make the offering to His Holiness? Why can't the nuns ever do it? They just think that we're not worthwhile. And then, you know, after the special offering, then the monks passed out all the offerings to the whole assembly. And I'm saying, why do the monks always get to stand up and pass out the offerings? They're special. What about us? And then I realized, I imagined flipping the situation where the nuns made the offering to His Holiness and the nuns passed out the offering. And I realized that then my mind would say, oh, why do the nuns need to stand up to make the special offering and the monks get to continue sitting down and being comfortable? Why do the nuns have to pass out the offerings to everybody else? We have to do all the work and the monks sit down and be comfortable. Are you getting what I'm saying? This was a big shock to me to see, you know. And I realized that it was my own mind that created the unhappiness about what I perceived as gender equality, you know. Because depending upon who's doing what, I always make my side into the side being discriminated against. So I could sit there and do poor me. Okay. You know, poor me is kind of a, you know, one of my favorite pastimes. You know, poor me, pauvre de me, pauvre de me. Yeah, do any of you go into poor me? Can I see any of you have any compatriots who love to sit and wallow in how the world is not good enough to us? And how other people oppress us and are mean and cruel and they don't understand us and love us. Okay, so, you know, begin to see how I frame situations in certain ways that really invokes my own self-pity. Yeah. And then, of course, if I feel sorry for myself, then I don't have to do anything because it's everybody else's fault. I can just sit there and feel sorry for myself and wallow in my misery and wait for everybody else to change. So that's not going to work. That doesn't work very well to bring about happiness. Okay. I also began to notice that my teachers weren't, on a personal level, my teachers always treated us very equally. I saw that for the Tibetan nuns, the situation was quite difficult. The monks received more offerings. They had a much better education. When I first came here 30 years ago, the nuns did not do any study, really. Now they have a whole education program and there's a lot going on. But still, the nuns receive less offerings. They're less well-respected in Tibetan society. I began to notice that because I lived in the community here. But I also noticed that on a personal level with my teachers, that they treated the men and women equally. And they gave us equal opportunity as much as they could within the Tibetan social system, you know, which isn't equal. Okay. And I also began to realize that some of the lamas did not understand when we started to talk about gender discrimination, it never even entered their mind. No. And it's interesting because whenever you're in the majority group, in whatever situation of inequality we talk about, whenever you're in the majority group, you don't identify with those qualities that the other group identify with as making them different. Okay? So in a situation where there's racial equality, inequality, let's say I'm American, so in the U.S. between, let's say, the African Americans and the European Americans, okay? So there's racial equalities. When you're European American, you don't go around all day thinking, I'm white, I'm white, I'm white. But when you're African American, you're quite self-conscious, you know, that you're different than the majority and you're being discriminated against. Okay. In a situation of sexual orientation where there's discrimination along that line, straight people don't go around thinking all day, I'm straight, I'm straight, I'm straight, you know. But people who are gay are very aware of being gay, you know, because it's different. When you're in a situation of gender equality, men don't go around thinking, I'm a man, I'm on top, I'm a man, I'm on top, you know. But women, when we apply for jobs, when we try and make our voice heard, you know, we're aware that we're not treated equally, okay? So I began to see that the Tibetan men, and especially the monks, were not aware of gender equality. And there was one situation. It was in 1993. We had a conference of Western Buddhist teachers with His Holiness. And there was one morning where, or afternoon, we presented the issue of gender discrimination within Buddhism. So there's this, so some of us women met the night before and planned it out. And then one woman, did the presentation, a brilliant, German woman, Sylvia. And so she started out. And, you know, here's this room. There were Tibetan monks in it. No Tibetan nuns, because they never come to any of these things. But Western men and women and Western monks and nuns. Okay, so Sylvia starts out, and she said, okay, Your Holiness, I'm going to lead you on a visualization. You're a man, and you come to Tibetan Buddhism. And there's Her Holiness, the Dalai Lama, who has been a woman in all 14 incarnations. There's the 16 arhats, all women. Yeah. There's Jesongkhapa, a woman. There's all the deities, most of them women, except for Manjushri, who's a man. And when you teach, you know, when you come in and you see Her Holiness teach, there's all nuns sitting around her everywhere in the crowd. And the men are in the back of the room. And so you begin to wonder if there's any discrimination against you as a man coming into Tibetan Buddhism. So you go and you ask Kwan Lama, who was, of course, a woman, because all the lamas are women. And you ask her, is there any gender discrimination against men? And she says, no, no, men and women are completely equal. But it's very good in your future life if you pray to be a woman, because you'll have more opportunities to practice if you're born as a woman. And so you're thinking about it. So then you go to ask another lama, and you ask her, is there any gender discrimination against men? And she says, oh no, in emptiness, everybody is equal. But your seat is over there in the back. And you're still puzzling about it. So you ask another lama, you know, is there any gender discrimination against men? And she says, oh no, in Tantra men and women are equal. You as a man can become enlightened just as fast as, you know, the women who practice Tantra. And you're so fortunate because you can be a Dhaka and bring them all great bliss. So you're still puzzling about this. Okay, so by this time, the Westerners in the room, we are cracking up. We are laughing and laughing and laughing, you know. And the Tibetans are just sitting there. They didn't get it. They really sincerely didn't get it. Yeah? So this was like a big wake-up to me because we were just laughing so much. Okay? So what I realized at that time was, you know, we are working in, each society has their own stuff, right? You know, each society has their own neuroses. Yeah? And each society has a hard time often seeing how they treat other people and what their own patterns are. Hmm? Okay. So, in societies where, I mean, even if you look in the Catholic world, you know, they have incredible difficulty understanding gender inequality in the Catholic world. Okay? So this is kind of across the board. What I also began to realize in my journey, my spiritual journey, is that it is extremely important to differentiate between the pure Dharma, the teachings that the Buddha gave, and religious institutions and social customs which were created by human beings. Because the pure Dharma came from the Buddha describing how he liberated his own mind. And he described that out of compassion so that we can liberate our own minds in the same way. Those teachings are pure. Those teachings are infallible. You know, they work for everybody across the board. Social institutions that were developed afterwards, or even social institutions that were developed at the time of the Buddha, exist within cultures. They are influenced by history, by economics, by cultural values, by whatever discriminatory patterns exist within that culture at that time. So religious institutions, by their own nature, because they're created by human beings, are flawed. And so it's so important to discriminate the Dharma from the institution. You know, and I really struggled with this for a long time until I figured out that this was my problem, is that I was mixing the two together. Okay? And I realized I came into Buddhism for the sake of the Dharma, because the Dharma touched my heart. And every time I checked the Dharma according to reason and logic, according to my own experience, whenever I tried to practice it over a period of time, I saw that it held true and it worked to pacify my mind. Okay? And that's what I was coming for. I was coming for those teachings that would help me pacify my mind. Okay? I wasn't coming for Tibetan culture. I wasn't coming for, you know, the brocade on the throne and for the high seats and for all this stuff about incarnate lamas and for the long horns and for the blessed pills and initiations with blessed waters. I was coming, you know, not for this external stuff that had to do with culture and convention, but I was coming for the teachings that would show me how to free my own mind. Okay, and how to develop love and compassion and wisdom equally for everybody. Okay, so I had to get my own motivation very clear. Okay, I'm coming for the teachings. Social institutions, like everywhere in the world, created by human beings who have afflictions, they're going to be imperfect. I'm living in an imperfect world. Let's not expect social institutions, religious institutions, to be perfect. They're not going to be. Okay? Why aren't they going to be? Well, in a Buddhist sense, because all Buddhists are not Buddhists. Okay, think about it. You know, all Christians are not Christ. All Buddhists are not Buddhists. We are training. We are in process. It took the Buddha himself 3 countless great eons. Okay? So it's going to take a while. So when we're living in a society of people, they're not always going to all be enlightened. I'm not enlightened. If I look at my own mind, I'm not free from discrimination. Maybe I discriminate against other people. Not the same people that I'm accusing these people of discriminating against. I discriminate against other people. But if I look at my own mind, you know, and I'm really truthful, I don't see everybody totally equally. I'm trying to practice so that I can. Okay? I value the teachings that teach me how to free my mind from discrimination and bias and prejudice. But I can't truthfully say that I've actualized those teachings in 100% of situations across the board. So if I haven't, why do I expect everybody else around me to have done that? You know, that's not fair of me, is it? I'm allowed to be imperfect. They are supposed to all be perfect. Okay. So it was a big thing for me to really begin to accept that, you know, the teachings are fantastic. And, you know, Buddhist communities in all the countries have produced really remarkable practitioners and very holy beings. But not everybody who's a Buddhist is a Buddha. Okay? But people are trying. They have faith. We all do what we can according to our own dispositions and capabilities and, you know, that particular life. But let's not expect everybody to be perfect. Because anyway, you know what I discovered also on my spiritual journey? I learned what the definition of perfect was. Okay? When I want people to be perfect, okay, perfect means that they do what I want them to do when I want them to do it. Yeah? When they do that, they're perfect. When they don't do what I want them to do when I want them to do it, then they're imperfect. Okay? So I began to see my total, you know, again, my prejudice, my imputing false expectations on other people, you know, and how my own garbage mind created so much problems for me. Okay? Now, let's look specifically at some of the things that you might see, even in scriptural passages, okay? So one of the ones that people often get upset about is in Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life by Shantideva, who is a great Indian sage, and in Chapter 8, when the chapter on meditation, okay, he's talking about going off into solitude, to do very deep meditation, to develop equanimity and equalize and exchange ourselves with others. And so he starts the chapter off, and he's talking about all of the hindrances that we have to developing single-pointed concentration in our mind. Okay? Now, many of you may have experienced some of those hindrances to concentration. Okay? Yeah? With the mind wandering off. So what does our mind wander off to? Well, we think about all the people who've done us wrong, right? we think about food. Yeah? Do you ever sit in meditation? You know, there's a Venerable Namgyal saying, you know, visualize the Buddha sitting on a lotus, sun and moon. And you visualize pizza with mushrooms and cheese instead, you know. Or the Buddha holding a pizza, or, you know, or you're focused on the Buddha's alms bowl and what's in it because you want to eat it. Yeah. Or you're dreaming about the chocolate cake down in town and wondering if you can sneak out during a break time and go and buy some chocolate cake without anybody at Tushita noticing that you've done it. Okay. So our mind goes to food, right? Because food's an object of attachment. Yeah. Our mind goes to our friends. Yeah. You're away from your friends now, so you're sitting in meditation. You know, visualize the Buddha. Oh, there's my friend. There's my parents. There's all the people at home that I love so much. All my friends. I miss them. Okay. You can spend a whole meditation session daydreaming about your friends, can't you? And your relatives and your loved ones. And just sitting there, imagining being with them, how wonderful it is. Whole meditation session. Why? Because our mind is attached to them. Okay? So our mind very easily goes to objects of attachment. What's another object of attachment that our mind goes to? Sex. Right? You know, you're sitting there in meditation, visualizing the Buddha. All of a sudden, the Buddha morphs into somebody you're sexually attracted to. And there you are. Now you have single-pointed concentration. So, very clear visualization. You know exactly what they look like. You know exactly what you want to experience, what you want to do. You're completely absorbed, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, you go, oh, my goodness. Yeah? Okay? So our mind goes to sex because we're attached to whoever it is we're sexually attracted to. Okay? We have these bodies and, you know, we have minds that have attachment in them, and so that's what happens. Okay? It doesn't matter whether you're male or female. It happens. It doesn't matter whether you're gay or straight. It happens, right? Okay? Especially when you're young. This is one good quality about growing old. Okay? One thing I really appreciate about growing old is your sexual energy goes down. Oh, what a relief. You know, because sexual energy when you're young, I mean, it can be really, it's a pain in the neck sometimes, isn't it?